Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of July 7th through 14th. This week we conducted an interview with Ron Hansen, author of the new novel Exiles, which is a historical piece about Gerard Manley Hopkins and the five nuns who drowned on the Deutschland, which inspired Hopkins' poem Wreck of the Deutschland. We spoke to Ron from his home in California by telephone. We began by asking him how long he's been a fan of the poetry of Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Well, I discovered him when I was in college. I had first become a big fan of Dylan Thomas, and I read a biography of him, and it pointed out how influential Hopkins was for Thomas. Even though our anthologies that we were using at the time only had one or two poems, I got in touch with other poems and realized how amazing he was. And finally, when I was in my early 40s, I was taking classes in spirituality, and I decided to use my enthusiasm for Hopkins to talk about spirituality. And those were the first essays I wrote about him.
And The Wreck of the Deutschland, which this book is inspired by, when did you first read that poem in particular?
I think I was probably in my mid-30s before I read The Wreck of the Deutschland. It was so intimidating that I would get into the first stanzas but not understand what was going on. And gradually, as I started getting more background material, I saw how essential it was to know the history of the story. And when I finally did know what actually happened to the Deutschland on the east coast of England, I realized what Hopkins was trying to say in the poem. Then that's when I got the idea originally to tell other people what the story of the Deutschland was so they could understand the poem better.
Now, of course, the name of the book we're talking about is Exiles, and you write about these five nuns who drowned on the Deutschland, and it's clear that they were exiles. They were expelled, or numerous religious orders were expelled from Germany during the time of Bismarck. But you also suggest that Hopkins himself was also an exile. In what ways was that true?
As soon as Hopkins converted from Anglicanism to Roman Catholicism, he became what was called in England at the time a pervert, a person who left the Church of England. And so he is in some ways exiled from his community at Oxford University. He was certainly ostracized by his family, who were, even though they're kind of formulaic Anglicans, they still felt a devotion to it. The kind of fidelity to religion that was mixed in with their fidelity, their loyalty to their country. So he was exiled from his family as well. And then after he became ordained and went from one university or high school studying to the other, he had that sense of constantly being on the move, being kicked out of a community and moving on to something else. So that there was very much a sense of exile and his constant traveling, his itinerant life. And then, of course, when he ended up in Ireland, where the British were not kindly looked at, his last 5 years were there, so there was a profound exile. In fact, one of his poems was called To Seem a Stranger, because that's exactly how he felt about his life. So there was a keen connection in all those aspects.
Now, you mentioned some of the essays you've written on Hopkins and the spirituality of his poetry, and you write in one of them that his poetry sought to imitate the mind and spirit at moments of what you called grace perception. Is that also what you sought to do in this novel?
Sure, that's what every novelist wants. I was trying to understand him, to get over the kind of enigma that other people have addressed having to do with Hopkins. And I think it's almost impossible, of course, even a psychoanalyst doesn't completely understand his or her patient. But I got a keener sense of him just by reading his letters, his journals, and all the other writing that was outside of his poetry. And you got a sense of his wit, his incredible intelligence, his skills as a critic. All those things elevated him in my estimation. And I saw, too, that we always think of him as writing those sonnets of desolation. But you can see that he was actually coming out of that period. His last two poems are not of desolation at all, I don't think. I think they're actually appreciations of his friend Robert Bridges and addressed their complicated relationship in really interesting and complex ways. guise of vanquishment, almost like the Psalms of complaint. They're much more appreciative. And he was getting into art more often, and he was writing music. There are all kinds of examples of his gifts coming to the fore.
You mentioned Robert Bridges, who was his first editor of the work that was published posthumously. Now, he, among others, blamed the Jesuits for wasting Hopkins' talent. Do you think things could have been different for him if he had perhaps different superiors, or was he just kind of a man ahead of his time?
I think both those aspects are true. I think that some of his superiors were less appreciative of his gifts. They thought him as eccentric and freakish in some ways. I think also he was out of his time. He was writing a kind of poetry that he knew was going to be appreciated later. In fact, he says that in one of his letters, that he doesn't expect people to read him now, but he expects to like him in 100 years. So he knew he was ahead of his time. But, it was a combination of those things, and there was really no place to put somebody like him. He probably would have been better off if he returned to teaching classics to young Jesuits. But instead they had a lot of other ministries that they had to put bodies into. So he ended up teaching high school kids. That was clearly not what he was best at. He was either pitching his conversation way too far over their heads, or he is involving himself in details that were really not that important in terms of grading and teaching.
Now, in what ways did Hopkins' Jesuit spirituality influence his poetry and his ministry?
The whole first 11 stanzas seem to have a lot to do with his encounter with Christ in the spiritual exercises. And after that, when he was writing his other kinds of nature poetry, it's clearly a product of one of the exercises, which is the contemplation to attain the love of God, which is to see how God animates everything in the world. So an appreciation of a bird in its flight is in some ways an appreciation of the Creator. And it's very much like him that he would say in a poem like the Wind Hover, he would immediately think of Jesus, of Christ my Chevalier. They pronounce it Chevalier. I think that is a very Jesuit way of looking at the world, encountering all of creation and seeing it as an expression of God's creativity.
Now, you dedicate your book to one Jesuit, Father Josephini, and also Paolo Mariani, both Hopkins scholars. How did their work contribute to this book?
What was most useful was that both Joe and Paul were working on books on Hopkins at the time, so they were alive to all the concerns that I was encountering. And I could just shoot them an email and get an answer back within the day on a lot of the questions I had. I would say, who is the provincial of England at this time? And Paul Mariani would have the answer for me. I would ask Joe Feeney about the customs for the Jesuits in the 19th century, and he would shoot back an answer on that. So it was incredible. And Paul Mariani and I ended up going to St. Finos, to the retreat house there. We did a six-day retreat together, and that was really valuable to actually see the ground that Hopkins walked on and appreciate the order of the day that they had there, and just to see England from his vantage point, and Wales as well.
Now, this was where Hopkins did his theology?
Yes.
And it was among his most productive years in terms of writing poetry?
Yeah, the year that he was ordained was called the Miracle Year because he produced some of the poems that are anthologized most often, like God's Grandeur, Pied Beauty, are all from that period. The Wind Hover are all from that period when he was about to be ordained. So that's incredible that he just had this burst of creativity. And he had a hard time getting poetry writing done after that because after he moved into being a real practicing priest, he was just so incredibly busy that he didn't have much time for his poetry. And that was a constant complaint in all of his letter writing.
Now, we've spoken about Hopkins, which is one part of the book, but the other part, as we said, is the life of these 19th century women religious who were drowned on this boat. Now, not as much is known about them and their historical circumstances.
Right. I knew their names. I knew their birth dates. knew basically where they were from. I knew when they were accepted into the religious order, and when they took vows, what their names were, their vows names, that is. I didn't know very much else. The only picture that survives of any of them, as far as I can tell, is of the four lying dead in the basement of a church. And then it's from a remote vantage point, so you can't actually see what their faces are like. But I did know one was 6 feet tall and had a very deep masculine voice, and one was very small. And then I didn't know very much about the other, so I had to invent. Well, you went to resources like biographies and autobiographies of other founders of religious orders in the 19th century, just incorporated some of their tales about how they found a religious vocation and what their lives were like to make a kind of analogous to what I was talking about.
Now, this I found some of the most appealing sections of the book, where you've recreated the life of these women religious. Of course, you also wrote about women religious in Marriott and Ecstasy. Is there something about their life that is inherently interesting to you?
I think it's because they're so contrary that they have deliberately sought to become poor, to become obedient, to become celibate. That is so countercultural, it's fascinating. And in some ways, by giving up all their power, they gain power. They have a sense of empowerment that a lot of women didn't have at that time. They got educations that they probably would not have been able to have access to in the 19th century. All these things that are kind of steps into enclosure actually gave them a sense of freedom. And I was fascinated by that. And also that they could be absolutely happy in these environments where you would think the privations would make them miserable.
Now, one of the most compelling scenes in the novel is where the nuns are near death and near drowning, and they have a conversation trying to come to grips with how God would let this happen. That also is a theme that runs through Hopkins' poetry. Was it difficult to dramatize this kind of big theological question?
Yeah, it was. I did want to have the various kinds of responses that people have to calamity. Like, this is to teach us something, or we must have done something wrong, or good will come of this. People are always vexed with encountering tragedies and trying to figure out why God would allow it. And that's the whole question of theodicy that comes in. You know, if God is good, why does evil exist in the world? These are questions that people have been struggling with for a long time. So I gave voice to those questions. I don't really answer them. I think everybody has to answer that, those questions for themselves. But I think the key thing is to recognize that in your misery, God is there, despite how it looks, how misfortune trails us, plagues us, persecutes us. It's not because of something we did. It's just that these things happen.
Now, a common approach to write about fictional characters, a common approach to historical fiction seems to be to write about fictional characters who kind of brush up against real-life figures. But here, as in some of your other novels, such as The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, you write directly about these characters themselves. Is that a challenge, given that there's already, you know, a lot of lore surrounding these individuals?
Yeah, it is a challenge. I thought it was more interesting to actually tell the story of the real people, because the real stories and all their complications are ways of illuminating deeper issues. I always have to make it clear that even though I'm incorporating as much that is factual about these people as possible, they're still my character. And in some ways, I'm sure I'm wrong. I'll find out when I meet Hopkins in heaven. Sure, I got him in some ways wrong. But I even other things I've done, I wrote an essay about the murder of the Jesuits in El Salvador, John Sperino wrote it, and he said, well, you got some things wrong, but the basic element of it you got right. And that's what I aim for, is just have the basic thread of it be correct to the circumstances and to the history. And I don't worry too much about details that are going to be wrong.
Well, again, the book is Exiles, which has just been published, and we want to thank Ron Hansen again for chatting with us, and good luck with the book.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine Podcast. Just a reminder that you can respond to our podcast at our site, americamagazine.podbean.com, and we will post those and read some of them on the air as well. You can also go to that site to subscribe to our podcast via iTunes or other MP3 services. I want to thank Bill McGarvey for providing the music for this week's show. You can learn more about him at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.